I'm trying to record an intro to this episode, and there's an ambulance going, and there's a motorcycle outside and a dog. Anyway, it's just ironic. I wanted to open up, and I wanted to talk about the idea of how, you know, writers are always writing on a delay, and, you know, you're experiencing things in retrospect, you know, while having to fill the reader in on that in-the-moment feeling. I had this whole, you know, sort of intro written out, talking about how it's similar to therapy and how you dive back into that mental space, you know, that you've locked up and so conveniently, you know, misplaced the key to. And I was going to relate this to how it's, you know, being an author is, you know, blah, 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 whatever, isolation, self-doubt. You know, it was, I was waxing philosophic just to kind of, you know, make a point that, right now in this day and age, we are getting to know one another on a delay. It's very specifically social media. There is this long delay that you don't realize while you're getting pelted with information from so many different, you know, channels all at once. The people that you love, you experience their lives on a delay in a very different way than you might have 10 or 20 years ago. You know, you may hear news 2 months after the fact, just scrolling through someone's Facebook feed or Twitter or Instagram or however they choose to display their lives and keep everyone updated on them. Social media has allowed us to engage with one another as if we are reading each other's diaries. So what does this do for death? You know, when we experience the loss of someone, and now we can look back on everything they did in retrospect. That person, they can't make edits or revisions, and everything they say has this almost eternal foreshadowing applied in various contexts. So how did I even connect with Tracy Faust? That's what this episode's about. You know, I didn't grow a true personal connection with Tracy, and really until after she died, reading her book and her words and thinking, man, this is someone I would have loved to have talked to. I can't even recall the exact moment that we initially met. I can only recount the respect that I grew for her over the ensuing years through her online posts and periodic stories of hers that I read, and now, well, once she was gone, I got to learn all about this person that I had longed for a past where that I had known her better. So I would like you to get to know her better. I want everyone to know who Tracy was and all about her fun little eccentricities about, you know, panic attacks and worries, and you're going to get to see, hear just a whole mess of those. And it's going to be performed through the voices of a couple dozen writers that have appeared on this program for the last two seasons. And now, this week's episode is titled Nowhere Near Normal, written by Tracy Faust and performed by the authors of the Storytellers Telling Stories podcast, with musical composition and a final performance by Maya Wynn.
At night, the minutes just before bedtime were the roughest.
There was a bleakness inside me.
There was a bleakness inside me.
A devastation that made the mossy redwoods and spearmint ground a place I could belong in.
A place I could belong in.
A place I could belong in.
If I could just calm myself down.
If I could just calm myself down.
I wrote in my ledger and read my tape with my medicine instructions.
Just so I could see my mother's handwriting.
The other girls talked about how scary the woods looked outside the window.
But I felt more like the scariness
was inside. There was no 11 o'clock news,
no theme from the streets of San Francisco
blaring from the living room where my grandmother had fallen asleep.
No touching my tongue to the window locks of our cabin, or checking the Dixie cups in the bathroom
to make sure
there wasn't even amount. Some nights you'll have dreams about the girl you teased.
The girl who was more like you than you realized.
And you'll see her not catching you in her arms.
So that your brain
spill out all over your happy white patio.
You'll wake up in a sweat.
Like water from a polluted sea.
Wondering how different your life would be now.
Had that girl just gone off and smacked you cold in the face.
Anything to not feel yourself slow and floating.
A shuttling's goodbye. Anything to stop making excuses for why you can't drive
on the freeway.
Why cold medicine makes you drowsy
and forgetful
will end up meaning so much. Anything, goddamn it.
Whatever it takes
to erase the day
and collapse into yourself.
You collapsed into yourself.
In Tracy's memoir, Nowhere Near Normal, she talks a lot about her panic attacks and her obsessive compulsive disorder. Two things that she struggled with, you know, along with health anxiety and understanding exactly what the driving force for all these mechanisms was. Tracy spent a great deal of her life navigating the inner workings of her mind. And while one might argue that many of these panic attacks that Tracy suffered had robbed her of hours or years of her life, they provided her with these deeply profound introspective thoughts.
I'm going to die soon, I would say. See, that's what all the fainting feelings are about, because I'm being shown what it will be like when the time finally comes. You know, like being prepared so I won't be so scared when it happens. I knew it sounded crazy when I put it out there, but that's what I really thought. Whenever I would get to the whirling tail end of a panic attack, I would tell myself,
Keep steady and wait.
Blood would recede from my limbs, and my pulse would slow quietly in my eardrums. I'm not entirely sure how I came up with the idea, but I started to think
all of it was a sign.
Each attack left me feeling so drained I could barely keep my eyes open in the minutes that followed the adrenaline peak. But when the heaviness went away, something weird began to happen. I felt this sort of power, like I could do anything.
Anything.
Like I'd been to a place no one else had been. And knew things
no one else knew.
It was as if my panicky episodes were little death previews, and when each one finished, it was a perk to go out there and live and
live and live
and live
and live
and live
and live
and live.
It didn't matter where I was or what circumstances caused me to hyperventilate and cry. The attacks always began the same way.
Everything dark and shrinking.
Shadow gnomes laughing through the filthy periscope lens of my peripheral vision.
Sometimes my whole body would tingle. Sometimes only my chest. But each time, the tightness never let go. Like the whole of me had been wrapped in an ACE bandage. I could actually feel the valves of my heart open and close, my pulse spewing out my blood,
taking it back,
in and out, hiss and growl.
They're going to see you faint.
They'll know what a loser you are.
Know what a loser you are.
When my dad found me in the downstairs bathroom of the condo he now shared with Sarah, I was sniffing air from the paper bag I carried around in my purse.
What's this all about?
I feel so sick.
I answered.
My burrito tasted funny. Did your burrito taste funny?
Ask questions. Take the eyes off you. Say something clever.
I think the Mexicans are involved in some sort of conspiracy to spread diarrhea to everyone in all bordering states.
He looked like maybe he believed me. You get really good at that sort of acting, when you're trying hard to cover up the fact that you know your lungs are going to burst and you'll just die right where you are and your body will crumple to the floor. Not unlike the way they found your dead great-grandmother after she lit her eyeballs on fire. You're not cool.
You're not that cool.
You're not cool.
Or brave enough.
Or brave enough.
Or brave enough.
You're not cool or brave enough to do something that bold. So all they'll find is your skinny body like a 10-year-old boy with bad armpit odor due to your inability to remember that you need more deodorant than most people.
Maybe it'll be the guy who drove the coroner's van who'll find you.
The one you totally flirted with after a man you maybe helped kill had passed away because...
Most of the time?
Most of the time.
Most of the time you possess no ability...
No ability...
You possess no ability...
To think of anyone but yourself.
Anyone.
Anyone...
But yourself.
But yourself.
And the coroner guy will see how disgusting your limbs are in the early stages of rigor mortis, and he'll smell your smell. Then he'll go home and hold his girlfriend extra tight and thank God he never got involved with you, because what kind of basket case drops dead on the floor with her face in a paper bag? Everyone will see you this way.
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 So you're just gonna have to teach yourself how to make the world think you're almost the same as them.
You're almost the same as them.
You're almost the same as them.
You're just going to have to teach yourself how to make the world think you're almost the same as them.
That's exactly what I did.
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 Going through Tracy's memoir, you get this feeling, this sensation that she felt responsible for everyone that she knew. You know, almost as if she was unsure of how people could even manage to survive without anybody looking out for them. And I believe that came from long bouts of introspection, understanding what she herself needed. She needed people. Such as when her sister was getting married and moving out. And that experience got Tracy thinking even further down the line what it would be like without having her sister around at all.
Sometimes people with OCD think they're responsible for everyone's happiness and peace. Sometimes they think those words don't really exist.
But you know what I was thinking when I threw my backpack from my window, then climbed out into the dark street below and ran like hell to the nearest bus stop?
Baby turtles. The saltwater kind that hatch all over the beach all at the same time and have to find their own destined path to the water or else they'll get eaten by seagulls or trampled on by surfers or whatever.
When I was little and my father and I watched his Mutual of Omaha nature shows together, I remember how he explained to me that this night journey into the sea was the turtles' one shot.
Their big chance to make it to the water and begin their lives. I remember thinking, how could they even know where to go without their mothers?
How could they even think about such a brave journey if a grown-up wasn't there to help them? As I waited for the bus and rinsed my mouth with the pink powdered hand soap in the bathroom of the Greyhound station, I was still thinking of those turtles and wondering about their paths.
Maybe it wasn't so scary for them to get to where they were supposed to be because it was pure instinct they were following. Maybe they just needed to do it by themselves and let their senses feel the way for them.
I paid for my ticket and sat alone on a metal bench with my backpack double knotted around my waist for safety.
Maybe those turtles just needed everything else out of the way.
For weeks, I've been watching my sister fill boxes and label things and hum the Carpenter's song, "We've Only Just Begun."
Just begun.
I
couldn't help but think of all the times we've moved out of here, moved into there.
All of us bubble wrapping old problems into new and better ways to survive.
All of us wondering what things would be like. Now she was the only one packing, bent over a cedar chest of embroidered sheets and delicate beginnings.
Ambitious and promising as a new religion.
She had taken the big stuff first, the good stuff.
Clothes,
makeup, her collectible Avon
perfume figurines,
all her romance novels and albums. But the posters of John Travolta, her bulletin board with her high school graduation picture, and caricature drawings of friends on Fisherman's Wharf.
All the stuff that didn't matter anymore.
Didn't matter.
Was still there.
Was still there.
The first time I saw her walking down the stairs
with her arms
overflowing with new life things, I said,
"You look like you're going to be gone a long time.
You look like you're going to be gone a long time.
You look like you're going to be gone a long time."
She laughed. If it works out, forever.
Forever.
I thought, how dumb.
How dumb.
How dumb. Forever.
Nothing's forever.
Nothing's forever.
Nothing's forever.
The women in my family had never found marriage to be the kind of good that requires forever. But in the phantom aura
of her almost empty room, that infinite word was as exact as
my own big nothingness. Sprinkles pranced quietly through the doorway, and I swear to God,
he looked like he cared about our new missing pieces.
Well, kiddo,
I said to him.
I guess that's that.
He jumped on my sister's bed, just a mattress now without a cover.
I kneeled and petted him while
he nuzzled my face.
If I got married, would you miss me
so much you wouldn't even be able to stand it? I buried my nose
in his dusty fur and tried to imagine what my house would feel like.
Without me in it.
Dr. Schmidt had a big fat pen from some head shrinker's convention that said,
Wherever you go, there you are.
There you are.
So then, if my sister wasn't technically here, did that mean that
none of her was here?
None of her was here?
The body goes off to all kinds of new and exciting places.
Takes all its clothes
to our apartment.
Or stays
at the old house with a midlife crisis.
And new girlfriends. Then what?
Is everything of that person just supposed to exist lightly in the places where the entirety used to be?
There was a story in one of my reincarnation books that said after we die, we're supposed to find the bellies of our new moms, jump into the baby inside her womb, and wait to be born. But what if we're not dead?
What if we're just gone?
Gone. Does someone come along
and take our place?
Maybe they pick us.
See what we're carrying inside.
Maybe they pick us. See what we're carrying inside. Then leap right into the clumps of lidless eyes and question mark spines. Maybe it's all a bunch of shit. I squeezed Sprinkles and watched a million charm bracelet sisters floating behind my eyes, dropping down from wherever shiny new souls drop down from.
Pick me!
Oh, but I would learn just how many ways there are to replace those lonely spaces.
Those lonely spaces between poor, poor you, married sisters, and dads in old houses.
You can make out with boys you hardly know. You can sneak cold medicine.
You can sneak cold medicine into your locker at school.
And drink it all day on those rare occasions you actually show up to school.
You can even run as far away as you can get on $50. Run from the places and people you hate.
Even though you know damn well, you're still stuck with the thoughts that aren't right. With a you that isn't right.
Sometimes the only thing you can do is just sit around and feel it all.
And nothing is going to make those things not happen.
Nothing is going to make those things not happen.
Not even if you've had too much champagne at your sister's wedding and you lie on her mattress face down trying to smell her smells.
But the only thing that comes up is a cold flush of air.
Like someone opening a door. Someone trying not to be. Wherever they are.
This might sound like an odd thing to say, but maybe not. I would love to know what Tracy would have to say about her own death, her own life. She had a wonderfully macabre sense of humor, as it shows in her writing. My own friend passed away just a couple of months ago. 3 months, actually. And I think she would have loved Tracy's book. Maybe that book would have helped her.
The night I took my first dose of antidepressant medication, I reminded myself of that, convinced myself I was not turning my life into a paragraph from a Hunter S. Thompson story.
I was also put on a drug called Buspar, a slow-acting anti-anxiety medication that works on your central nervous system so you're not lit up all the time.
Almost right away, those pills helped my mind to stop flashing neon. It hushed long enough to let me cry about not having a mother anymore, and would later help me cry about all those times I couldn't cry at all.
By the end of just 2 weeks on the Buspar, I was literally seeing the words, "Feel this." I even checked out 2 books on turn-of-the-century psychical and paranormal research, and actually read them both back-to-back. Slow was excellent for concentration, but it worried me a little.
I read as much as I could from those pharmacy pamphlets they give you when you start a new medication. I figured when the time came to feel super, I'd be ready. That's not exactly how it happened. There really wasn't a beginning of any kind of special feeling. It was more like a slow end to all those feelings that made me think in terms of the word special.
Separate.
Separate. Sadder than you.
Separate.
Sadder than you.
Sadder than you.
The first place I felt different was in my spine. I don't know another way to explain it. My back became full of something gelatinous and flowing, the opposite of glass.
I didn't feel like I had to jump up and run away. The oscillating place just above my tailbone was gone. Even when I cried, even when I screamed, I didn't cast fire.
For a while, it was upsetting not to feel that anymore, that familiar part of me that caused my brother to call me Spaz and made a running dialogue in my mind like toxic water.
Erratic was leaving. Imbalance was waving goodbye. From all the stuff I learned on the subject of mood-altering drugs, I found out that when antidepressants start working, it's common for people to miss their hyper-emotional life.
The crazy, depressed, anxious way they've been living. When the drugs start kicking in, and the familiar becomes unfamiliar. Then you get sad over not being sad. I felt like I was losing an important part of myself.
An important part of myself. Who was I supposed to be if I couldn't be upset about everything all the time?
Who was I supposed to be?
Who was I supposed to be?
Who was I supposed to be if I couldn't be upset about everything all the time?
Who was I supposed to be?
From such an early age, being me meant being annoyed, scratchy somehow. Sounds were too high, the ground wasn't stable. Even when I tried, it was hard to conjure a memory where something wasn't wrong.
I said this to the doctor when I went back for a refill. He asked me about the times I was in therapy and if that was something I wanted to continue. "I don't know what I want to do," I told him.
At the very end of Tracy's book is a list of resources along with an author's note. Tracy devoted a lot of her time to not just better understanding herself, but seeing how she could collect all of this information in a helpful way and redistribute it to others so that maybe they could also seek help when they needed it.
Author's note. Dearest reader, even with all the advancements in the practice of mental health medicine, there are still those in the general public, aka people who aren't big readers and or thinkers, who enjoy sticking labels on folks who reach out for help with anxiety or depression issues.
If you are thinking about improving your life and the lives of those who love you by seeking help for your problems,
congratulations.
Congratulations.
You are living proof that we are, as many studies and health professionals suggest, on the higher end of the creative and IQ spectrum than those who claim to be, quote unquote, normal.
Also, you should know this.
On the journey to healing yourself, no matter whether you choose pharmaceuticals and psychiatric care, alternative medicine, or a combination of both, Get ready to hear this phrase slipping often from the mouths of those who may mean well, but really have no idea of what they are talking about.
I'm glad I could fix my anxiety depression on my own and that I never had to rely on any doctor or pill to help me.
While this is admirable in a don't ask, don't tell, 1950s happy housewife sort of setting, I can almost guarantee that these sturdy people did not suffer from a clinical mental health illness.
That, when they figure anything Dr. Jack Daniels can't cure, isn't worth having.
In almost all cases, as with most people who are sick, help is needed in the process to get well.
Don't let anyone tell you that asking for help is weak or against God, or that psychiatrists are involved in some sort of pharmaceutical conspiracy plan, or that it's disgraceful if you're not handling things all on your own.
If you think you need help, please get it. Do whatever it takes to make yourself well.
Don't let anyone or anything stand in the way of being the best person you can possibly be.
You have a right to feel good and find happiness.
Following our websites, books, or other resources to help you reach out for help with anxiety and depression.
I've used all of these myself at one point or another.
And I'm always adding new resources to my self-help list
because I truly believe that nothing gets taken care of by wishing it away.
Read.
Research.
Talk.
And listen.
But most important,
love yourself for the smart, awesome, weird, and wonderful creature that you are. Tracy.
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 That's awesome. That is so beautiful.
That's so good.
I know my world is changing, and I have to move on. I'm moving forward, I know that I'm ready. I'm moving forward so I can be free. Somewhere that's beautiful.
Tracy. You are the sound girl. No one like you for hearing the sounds and words. Lots of people get grammar, but you hear the sounds that make a difference.
Hi, Tracy. I just need you to know how much I love you. And I miss you, my sister. Please just know how much I love you. And you're not forgotten, ever. And I appreciate you, everything you've done for me in my life. I love you, baby girl.
So, Tracy, I'm so happy to have the chance to talk to you. It's been a long time, and it's really, really hard to believe that you're not around.
Hey, Tracy. Thank you for being there for me in ways that most wouldn't have, supporting my crazy ghost stories with your interest. I felt that I can identify with your OCD and your ways of cleaning, which made me feel somewhat normal, when really it's not to your average person.
Or proof of the fact that going through a lot can make you an even better person. I didn't know you when you were little, but I do think perhaps that having been through so much, you manage somehow to corral the negatives. And
I appreciate your laughter and the feelings which came with your interaction. I definitely miss you. I wish the world could have had you so much longer. Your heart and soul is beyond what anyone could call beautiful.
And I miss you so much. I miss you so much.
Corny as it sounds, I wish you were here. Alice.
Hey, Mom. It's Julian. There's 101 things I could say to you. And I know with you, wherever you are, whether it be hanging out with aliens or, hanging out with your mom, I know you're watching down at your boys. There's a lot of things that I wish I could have told you in person, with it being my girlfriend that I've been dating for 10 months, who I think you personally sent to me because she's been an amazing person. Helped me get through so much, and I wish you could have met her because you would have loved her. She has a sense of humor like you, you know, very sarcastic and dark. Well, maybe not as dark as you, but I'm trying to teach her that. But there's, you know, I have a new job and everything that has been going on in my life in the past year and a half that you haven't seen. I wish I could, you know, tell you, but at the end of the day, I do know you're watching, and I do know you're seeing everything that I do or Rocco does or even Ricky and Jordan. I tend to think about everything that we've, you know, done in the past. I always tell people the funny stories that you told me, or, you know, whether it was involving you and I or something you did as a child. Something that I always tell people is, it might not even be that I tell people this, but something I miss, one of the things I miss the most is how cool you were as a mother. Not only were you that mother figure in my life, but you were also one of my best friends. And it is something that stands out is coming home from school and it being the weekend and you're in the kitchen making a pot of top ramen or your famous chicken noodle soup, which I wish I knew the recipe for. So if you can ever come to me in my dreams and please tell me the recipe for that soup, because I want to know. I miss it. But, you know, just coming home from school and you're making some food in the kitchen or whatever and you have a haunting on, you know, one of those ghost shows that we always used to watch back in the day. And I would ask you if Jason or David can come home with me from school and have a sleepover. And he would say, of course, and we would hang out and we would talk at the kitchen table for hours. And, you know, we would talk about aliens or ghosts, or you would tell us the ghost stories that you experienced as a kid, or some of your OCD stories, which my friends always found very fascinating. Asking you if, you know, after 10 o'clock, if we could go and go ding-dong ditching, something that you always seem to be okay with. A lot of mothers would be like, no, never in a million years, but you were always that cool person that let us do it. There's so many things I wish I could say to you right now, but I think you already know what I want to say to you. I miss you every day. This hasn't been easy for me. If anything, it's gotten a lot harder, but I know you're hanging out there with your mom and your sister, and you know what the universe has in store for me and Rocco and, you know, Ricky and Jordan. And I know now that you know the question that you've always wondered, if aliens exist. So I really hope you know that. And because I know you've always wondered that. But I always wish you'd come to me in my dreams. You haven't yet, or maybe you have, and I just don't remember. But I know one day I will see you again. You've been a great spirit to everyone. You've lightened the lives of many people and showed people that being yourself is okay, and that your sense of humor is okay. And I just, you know, I miss you and I love you. And like I said, there's many things I want to say to you, but I know you'll come to me in my dreams and I'll say it to you then. But you were an amazing person, an amazing mother. You had a lot going for you. Fortunately, you were taken way too soon. I know you're looking down on everyone and making all your friends bitter writers, and I love you, and I'll see you again soon, Mom. All right.